Our beloved master, when Ungan himself became a master, he once said, when addressing an assembly of monks, "Here is a child from a respectable family. Whatever you ask, there is nothing he can't answer." One of his disciples, Tozan, stepped forward and asked, "How many books are there in his house?" Ungan replied, "He doesn't have any books, not even a single letter." Tozan then asked, "How could he be so well informed?" "He seldom sleeps day or night," was Ungan's response. "I want to ask something of the child," continued Tozan. "Is it possible?" "He could answer, but he would not," replied Ungan. On another occasion, Ungan asked a monk, "Where have you been?" The monk replied, "I have been talking about the Dharma to a rock." Ungan asked, "Did the rock nod?" The monk had no answer, and Ungan commented, "It nods before you talk."
Friends, first a little bit of news. The first failure of Comrade Gorbachev. The Central Committee of the Communist Party of Soviet Union has declared that Gorbachev's first act of reform to eradicate alcoholism has failed. The party declared that Gorbachev's radical changes have not yet been achieved. On the contrary, the sale of illicit liquor has grown. State liquor revenues had fallen, and the masses were constantly complaining about long queues to buy vodka. Second, over the past year, Comrade Gorbachev has allowed the following symbols of capitalism to do business in Russia: Coca-Cola, McDonald's, Kentucky Fried Chicken, and fast food pizza. This is all. That America wants to pour on the very innocent people of Soviet Union. Third, just today, he has allowed the world's largest advertising agency, Saatchi & Saatchi, to begin advertising campaigns in Russia for Western goods. Saatchis, who are advertising agents for Margaret Thatcher, said they would also like a contract to polish Gorbachev's image, although he does not really need it at the moment. On the one hand, he is talking that Russia's economy is failing, and on the other hand he is giving contracts to advertising companies to advertise in Russia the Western goods. Do you see the contradiction? The latest data about the economy of Russia is that 20% people are below nourishment level. But in America, only 14% people are below nourishment level. The difference is only 6%. If for just 6%, communism has to be thrown out, and American capitalism has to be brought in, it is a total tragedy. Six percent people can be held without bringing American capitalism in. There was no need to declare to the world that they are no more making nuclear weapons. There was no need to tell to the world that they are cutting in their military budgets and numbers of armies. They should have done it silently and raised the 6% without any problem. It is so simple, but he is going absolutely irrationally. He is throwing the baby with the bathwater. His effort is absolutely against Soviet Union. And this first failure of his policy will not be the only failure. This is the beginning of the end. All his policies are going to fail, because all his policies are against basic fundamentals of communism. And one man cannot undo 70 years sacrifice of millions of people who have created communism, the first experiment in the human history to bring a classless society into existence. Now the questions. The first question: according to your vision, what exactly is communism? Communism simply means removing private property in the hands of the collective. Because private ownership of property creates classes, the oppressed and the oppressors. And money brings more money, attracts more money, and poverty attracts more poverty. And a man who sees all around people having money, beautiful houses, cars, and he has not even food to eat, his dignity as a human being is destroyed. He starts feeling subhuman, inferior, unsuccessful. And to create this feeling in millions of people just for the few who will be rich is against whole humanity. Communism brings dignity to everybody because all the properties, the land, and everything belongs to the collective. Nobody can be richer than you and nobody can be poorer than you. Equality is equivalent to communism. An equal opportunity for everyone to blossom whatsoever he has hidden in his potentiality. Communism is only a first step of a great experiment. Once people are without inferiority complex, once religions are removed, that is part of communism, that there is no God, and the so-called religions are just opium of the people. Once religions are removed, soon a tremendous vacuum will be felt by everybody because these religions have been stuffing you with systems of belief which are all fiction. But they help to fill you that you are full. I have come across poor aboriginals in Bastar, in the central provinces of India, who sometimes don't get even one meal in a day. And without food, sleep becomes absolutely difficult. The stomach is asking for food, goes into cramps, you cannot sleep. I have seen with my own eyes people just drinking water to fill the stomach, to deceive the stomach, and putting a brick on their belly and binding it with a rope around, so the stomach feels that it is not empty. Inside water, outside the brick. But you can deceive by such false methods the stomach, but that is not going to give you nourishment. So they are just skeletons. Religions have been giving you false ideas, fictions, to console you. Communism means removing all fictions from human mind, giving it a good cleaning of all past that has filled it with rubbish. Marx's vision never reached beyond that. But my understanding and my vision is far more perfect. Communism is only a first stage to me, not the last. And as communism succeeds, people drop inferiority complex, which is needed by the priests, which is needed by the people who are driving humanity into different kinds of slavery. And when there is no God, there is no guilt. Without guilt, no organized religion can live. It is the guilt that takes people to the churches because they become afraid. They have committed sins, now they will suffer hellfire for eternity. So something has to be done to remove the guilt. All religions provide fictions. In India, just now there has been a Kumbh Mela. It is going on in Allahabad. Millions of people, perhaps this is the biggest fair in the world. Just go to the Ganges. To take a dip in the Ganges means all your sins are taken by the Ganges and you come out absolutely clean. That does not mean that you will stop committing sins. That simply means you have found a very cheap method to get rid of your sins and guilt. So you can commit as many sins as you want. There is no problem. Just a small journey to Allahabad, take a dip into Ganges, and all your rapes and murders and anything that you have committed, Ganges takes it away. This is the Hindu strategy to go on keeping you feel guilty. And the priests are there. You cannot take the dip alone. The priest has to take you into the Ganges in a boat, and he will be reciting mantras, and then you take the dip, and you have to pay the priest. The priest is the agent of the God who does not exist. In Catholic religion, you have to go to the priest to confess your sins, and just $10 and 5 Hail Marys, and your sins are erased. God has forgiven you. I have always wondered that not a single Catholic theologian, and they have great theologians, very intellectual, has not raised the question that when a man rapes a woman, and God forgives him just because he has given $10 to the priest and 5 Hail Marys, is God absolutely unaware of the woman who has been raped? The criminal is forgiven, and the victim? Not a single theologian of any religion have ever thought, what about the victim who has suffered? A man kills someone and he goes to the priest and he is forgiven. He goes to the Ganges, gives some money to the priest, takes a dip and he is forgiven. What about the murderers? God does not seem to be just. He is in favor of the criminals and sinners. For them, He is a father who forgives. But what about the victims? There is not a single word in any scripture of the organized religions which takes note about the victims. God seems to be favorable to the sinners, to the criminals, but not favorable to the victims. He has no sympathy for the victims. Now, just today I received a letter from a sannyasin who has been abused by his father in her childhood, sexually abused. And now she suffers continuously that nightmare that his father exploited her innocence. She did not know anything about sex and his own father. Now that father must have gone to the church and forgiven by God. What about this girl who is suffering even now? God has no consideration for this girl. And because the father has abused her, she has become afraid of sex. So she cannot fall in love. The image of the father comes in between. So she is suffering because of the father. She has nightmares about his father and all abuse that he has done to her. And because of all that, she has become frightened of love. If anybody approaches towards her, she will escape. So she will suffer more because she will never be nourished by love, because his own father has destroyed her trust in love. Her trust is completely finished. If the father cannot be relied upon, then on whom you are going to rely? But God has no consideration. This God is an absolute fiction created by the priests. Communism dissolves these priests, dissolves organized religion, takes away all the opium that they have been giving to the people. Marx was not aware that this is not going to be the complete phenomenon. I can see with more clarity than any Karl Marx or Lenin or Stalin. Communism has created a vacuum. You must be surprising, you must be continuously talking amongst yourself. Amrito informed me that in the canteen it seems the early days of Soviet Union before the revolution, when all young people were discussing about communism and revolution, the whole Soviet Union before the revolution was agog. Everybody was talking about what this revolution is going to be, what is communism. And there were anarchists like Prince Kropotkin and Bakunin who were talking about a world without state, without government, without any kind of domination. And they were discussed for all these days. You have been discussing, only the Indians had disappeared. They have come back today knowing that this is the last day. Such cowards, and they think they are spiritual. And if any problem is going to happen, it is going to happen to me, not to them. They are just listeners. Nobody is going to put them into jail. And they are not going to be sought, but they have all disappeared. I have been watching. Already there are only not more than half a dozen people who come from the Pune. But they also had disappeared. Seeing the danger. Communism creates a vacuum. That is why I support it. My whole vision is that that vacuum can be only filled by meditation. And I am against Gorbachev because he is filling it with Coca-Cola, bringing the priests back, opening the churches. I have some fundamental reason to oppose him, because he is opening the doors of all rubbish that took 70 years to finish by the communists. Now is the time that meditation should be introduced in Soviet Union. The door should be opened to the only people who are awakened, enlightened, the Buddhas. Because they can fill the vacuum not with any fiction, but with your own potential growing into the vacuum and blossoming into lotus flowers. So communism is a first step. The second step is spiritualism. And the third step is anarchism. Anarchism is not possible unless people are really authentically spiritual. Prince Kropotkin, Tolstoy, Bakunin, all were unaware of the fact that they are talking about the flowers, but they have forgotten about the roots and the trunk. You cannot create flowers without roots, without trunk. Communism is just the roots, and the trunk will be the meditation. And the flowers will be a world without any domination, without any interference with individual growth. A world without states, a world without boundaries, just a world consisting of individuals, not organizations, not nations, not races. So these are the three steps, and I can see them clearly because I have no identification with any. Either communism or spiritualism or anarchism. I am just a witness. I have no involvement with anybody. I am just a mirror who can reflect the whole situation as it is and even the future as it can grow if right nourishment is given. So don't think that I am a communist. I don't identify with anything. Don't think that I am an anarchist, I don't identify with anything. Don't think that I am a spiritualist, I don't identify with anything. I am just a pure awakened being, just a mirror who reflects, who has no involvement, no commitment to anything. I don't belong to any organization, I don't belong to any party, I don't belong to any ism. You have to understand clearly. I simply see things because I have gone beyond thoughts. My no mind is just a pure space in which I can see the actual growth of consciousness and how it should happen. So communism to me is just a basic ground. It is the roots. Spirituality is going to be the trunk and the branches and the foliage, and then at the highest peak comes the absolute freedom from all kinds of dominations, oppressions, suppressions, from all priests, from all politicians. You blossom like a Buddha. My only interest is to bring out your Buddha as a fully opened lotus in the early morning sun, with a small dewdrop shining so beautifully that even real pearls cannot compete with them. I am not a politician, but that does not mean that I am not interested in human welfare. And I will say things which may hurt to your prejudices. I want to destroy your prejudices completely. I want to create a vacuum. That vacuum is absolutely needed, otherwise you don't have a space to grow your potential. You are filled with religious rubbish, you are filled with political rubbish, you are filled with economical rubbish, all kinds of ideas that you have borrowed. You are not having your own insights. That rubbish prevents, it keeps you blind, it gives you a sense a fulfillment which is false. So remember it. It will be very difficult for outsiders to understand me. Almost impossible. Misunderstanding is the only possibility for me as far as the outside world is concerned. But at least you should not misunderstand me. I have no interest in Stalin and I have no interest in Gorbachev. My interest is in you. And when I see that you are filled with certain prejudice, I have to bring that prejudice on the surface so you can see. All kinds of moral, Puritan, programming. I have to fight so many enemies that you are nursing within you. But my whole concern is to make you utterly empty. So I am not preaching anything. I am not supporting anything. I don't have any doctrine, no philosophy, no cult, no creed. My whole effort is to clean your inside completely with all that the society, the education, the religion, the family have forced into you. Unless you get rid of it, you cannot grow in meditation. You cannot become a Buddha. Communism is a good opportunity than any other kind of social structure because it is negative, because it is without God, without heaven, without hell, without the idea of reincarnation. And it creates a certain equality of opportunity, equally to man and woman. I have told you just few days before that Gorbachev cannot succeed in prohibition. You cannot succeed in prohibition in India, a hot country which does not need any alcohol. It is absolute nonsense in a country like Soviet Union, which is half the year covered with snow, taking poor people's vodka that keeps them warm is absolute impossibility. He started with a wrong policy that shows he does not understand a simple arithmetic. If he wanted to be successful, he should have prohibited that nobody can drink his own urine. He would have been successful. Of course, you are allowed to drink anybody's, but not your own. And he would have been hailed as a messiah. Only one person, Morarji Desai, in India would have felt a heart attack. But who cares about Morarji Desai? In fact, he needs a heart attack. That would have successful immediately. The whole Soviet Union would have hailed Gorbachev as the greatest man of their history. Just choose the right things which are going to success. He is choosing wrong things now, his second policy, that women should go back. No woman is going to back. Women are professors, women are engineers, women are doctors, women are pilots in the army, and they have proved in the Second World War that they can fight soldier to soldier with every man on every front. They were bombers, they were flying planes to bomb. Now you cannot force them back. It is as impossible as once you have taken the toothpaste out of the tube. Then try to force it back and you will understand me how Gorbachev is going to be unsuccessful. Just a small experiment you can do in your bathroom. Nobody will know about your failure. Now these women who have lived as professors, doctors and engineers and pilots and scientists and academicians, you want them to go back to the kitchen? It is impossible. The whole womankind in Soviet Union will oppose Gorbachev. I have heard that his wife is very intelligent, is a law graduate, just as he is a law graduate. In fact, she should start a revolution against Gorbachev. She can understand the situation of women far better than Gorbachev. And for what he is doing this? Again reducing women to the second category of citizens. What is the reason? Just those 6%. If women are forced back into kitchens and imprisoned to take care of the babies and the husband and their financial independence is destroyed, there will be more posts vacant for men to occupy. Because there is a small unemployment that is creating that undernourishment. Just to give men more opportunities. So withdraw all women from their status that they have gained . Do you think he can succeed in it? A woman who has been lived as a free individual, not dependent on her husband's bank account. Only in Soviet Union women have their own bank accounts, their own salary, their own way of living. Only in Soviet Union women are free to move. They have their own clubs, they have their own societies, they have their own everything that they want. All over the world the woman is immobile. She is completely crushed. And her birthright for freedom of movement has been taken out. She can go only to the church. That's why in churches and temples you will find only women. Once I was addressing a meeting on the birthday of Krishna. And I was amazed. There were only women. It was a huge temple devoted to Krishna. And the speaker of that stage where I was speaking was the inaugurator of the meeting. And that's why I say these politicians are retarded. He was the speaker and the chancellor of the university. And he was inaugurating the meeting, not even seeing that women are sitting, keeping their back towards him, because they are gossiping with each other and looking into each other's clothes and each other's ornaments. Who cares about Krishna? They have this only possibility and only chance to meet with other women. The whole, and there must have been at least 20,000 people, maybe 1,000 men and 19,000 women. And they were grouped in separate small groups, because you cannot talk with 19,000 women, so 4 women, 5 women making a group. The whole meeting was divided into small groups and great gossip and so much noise. And that idiot speaker, his name was Pandit Kunjilal Dubey. Kunji means key, but it also means kunj. Kunj means a beautiful grove of flowering trees. So his name was given by his parents because Krishna used to play his flute by the side of the Jamuna River in a beautiful kunj, in a beautiful grove of mango trees. So he is called Kunj Bihari, Krishna's another name. His parents must have given him the name Kunjilal, thinking that Kunj is a sacred word for the worshippers of Krishna. But in Hindi, Kunji also means key, and Chabi also means key. But with Kunji there is a difficulty, it also means Kunj. So the whole university where he was the chancellor called him Pandit Chabilal Dubey, because Chabi exactly means Kunji, exactly means key. No problem about Chabi, there is only one meaning to it. So Pandit Chabilal Dubey was inaugurating the meeting, and I pulled his shirt and I told him that to whom you are talking. Nobody is. Women are sitting, keeping their back to you, and what kind of retarded mind you have got? Perhaps the students are right when they call you Pandit Chabilal Dubey. You are just retarded. And he was very angry with me because I was in the university, the professor, in his own university. But he knew me that if he does any fuss about, I will take him to task, and I don't care about any professorship. I used to carry my resignation always in my pocket. And I used to show them that only date has to be signed. Any moment you want my resignation, it is here. I keep it tied in my pocket. Who knows at what time? And I refused to speak. The organizers were very much disturbed. They said, what to do with these women? They were shouting on the mic again and again, stop gossiping, turn towards the speaker. Nobody was interested. Everybody knows about Krishna. What you are going to say about Krishna? And I simply refused to speak. I said, I am not an idiot. And this is my last time. Again, I will never accept any invitation by any organized religion. And anyway, you are fortunate that I am not speaking, because I was going to condemn Krishna as much as possible. So these women have saved you. I am going. And I told Pandit Chabilal that you come with me. Why are you sitting here? You have inaugurated, just finished. Come with him. I had to call him because he had the car. And out of fear, he started calling me Panditji. I said, never use that dirty word for me. you are Pandit Chabilal. I am not. I am not Pandit. Pandit means rabbi, bishop, priest. You think it is honorable? I think it is a four-letter word. You just drop it. Don't never use me, otherwise I will hit you. In his own car, he said, don't say so loudly. The chauffeur is there. I said, I don't care. He knows absolutely about you, who you are. And the chauffeur started laughing. It was a limousine, so he immediately closed the window. He said, you are a dangerous man. In my own car, I said, this car belongs to the state. It is not your own car. It belongs to me as much as it belongs to you. He said, what? I said, yes. It is state ownership. And I am as much a citizen of this state as you are. And you are a public servant. I am the public. He started looking outside the window just to avoid. But I said, I will continue. You have to listen. Why you have taken me into your car? He said, Stranger, you called me. I said, I had to call you because I have not brought my car. The organizer says, bring me in their car. Now that I have told them I am going to speak against Krishna, they are not going to give me their car. I needed a car. I don't need you. You can get out if you want. And your chauffeur is in my favor. You know, he had laughed. He said, you don't understand that I am also the chancellor of the university. I said, I don't care about chancellor and vice chancellors. I showed him my card. That card was my resignation. He said, why you are showing me this card? I said, I have just to put the date. Finished. You are no more my chancellor, and I can throw you out of the car. Just, I am being courteous to your old age. Because the danger is you may be finished if I throw you out. So keep quiet and don't harass me. He said, Stranger, you are harassing me in my own car. And it used to happen with that Pandit Chabilal Dubey in many places, because he was a speaker of the state and a great scholar of Hinduism and the chancellor of the university. Just by the virtue of being the speaker of the parliament, every speaker becomes the chancellor of that particular university where I was a professor. So I told him that you are not really even worthy to be a lecturer in the university. You are only BA, LLB, that too third class. He said, who told you? I said, I have my sources, your wife. She had shown me your certificates also. I have taken their photocopies. If you do any trouble for me, I am going to publish in the newspapers all those certificates. A third class BA, LLB, who is not even a postgraduate, is the chancellor of the university. He said it is better not to fight. I am sorry that I disturbed you, but don't publish anything. I had no copies of the certificate or anything. But I knew he is a third class LLB and he became politician because he could not succeed in the court. The same was the situation of Mahatma Gandhi. He became a politician because the first time he entered in the court, the whole night he has been preparing and preparing his first appearance in the Bombay High Court. And he was a barrister from England. And as he entered the court, his legs start trembling. And he could speak only one word, "Your Honor," and flopped down, perspiring, and has to be carried out. That's why he became a politician. But nobody bothers about the realities of life. These failures become politicians because politics needs no qualifications, no standards. This is the only profession which any idiot can enter. Communism to me is a very significant step towards the ultimate Buddhahood. The second question. Apparently, when Ronald Reagan or George Bush go to the church to kneel and pray to their God, at their side is an aide who carries the briefcase with the codes that allow the president to signal an immediate launch of their nuclear arsenal, thereby effectively terminating all life on Earth. But still, Stalin is the bad guy. Is there any limit to our hypocrisy? Even in the church, this is a fact. When Ronald Reagan used to go to the church, now George Bush, because White House has its own church, presidential church. One aide will carry a suitcase, and people became concerned what is in the suitcase. Why every day when Ronald Reagan is kneeling down and praying to God, one man stands by his side with his suitcase? Finally, it was discovered that the suitcase is not ordinary suitcase. It has all the buttons inside for nuclear weapons to be launched immediately from the church. If there is not time enough to reach to White House, where they have all buttons for nuclear weapons, this was a portable death to the whole earth. But it is carried still. Now it is George Bush who is kneeling, and one never thinks that what kind of hypocrisy. You are praying to God, you are kneeling down, and you are keeping by your side death for the whole planet. There is certainly no limit to our hypocrisy. We have succeeded only in creating a hypocrite world. It is not civilized, it is not culture. The third question, the USA avas with drugs, violence, mental illness and general alienation, it seems that Marx's much awaited crisis of capitalism has come, but it is a spiritual rather than an economic crisis. Would you please comment? This is the USA, full of drugs and full of nuclear weapons, mental illnesses, violence. Violence without purpose. I have told you, just few days before, 6 people were killed in LA because the cars were delayed. Some accident somewhere miles away must have happened. Now people get angry. They want to reach their home as quickly as possible. In LA or in New York, in San Francisco, you can reach your home from the office by walking quickly than by driving. This was discovered when once it happened that 3 days the electricity went out in almost half of America. And all light disappeared, elevators could not work. Signals on the road stopped, so traffic has to stop, otherwise there would have been tremendous clashes. When there are no signals giving red or green light to stop or to go, so whole traffic has to be stopped, people have to walk. Then they discovered that by walking they reach to the office quickly. They reach their home quickly. By the car, now car is absolutely moving with less speed in America than a bullock cart in India. For hours the traffic is jammed and it certainly creates anger. You are hungry, you want to go back to home to eat something, to drink something, and here you are sitting in the car just boiling, honking your horn. But that is useless because everybody is honking his horn for miles. So only you hear horns honking and honking. Then few people became so furious that they forgot completely that the man ahead is in the same trouble. He is not preventing you. Nobody knows who is preventing. Nobody knows what has happened far away. Maybe a truck has upturned, maybe a clash of 6 cars. And unless that has to be removed, unless the police comes, it cannot be removed because the police has to take care. Unless the insurance agent comes, it cannot be removed because insurance agency has to pay the price of the car. If the man has died, then more delay. One never knows what is happening. But people, 6 people, not one, just in one day, went so mad that they took out their guns and shot the people just ahead who was not at all responsible. But in anger, in rage, you become absolutely blind. It is not only that love is blind, hate is much more blinder. But nobody has said it. Love is blind. Nobody says about hate, how blind hate can be. Now this anger is absolutely madness. Shooting the poor fellow ahead, who is in the same jam as you are. And then immediately the sale of machine guns, automatic rifles raised. Every person who had a car purchased an automatic gun because it is dangerous. At least if somebody kills you, you can also kill somebody. It does not matter who is killed, but somebody is killed. At least you can show the gun. And people hang their gun on top of their head in the car, so everybody can know that beware. If you honk too much behind me or ahead of me, I'm going to shoot. And America is the only country perhaps where there is no license is needed for keeping such dangerous arms. Automatic guns, one gun can kill 160 people without changing the bullets. And you can purchase from any dealer. The dealer needs the license to sell, but the people who purchase, they don't need any license. And this mental illness, America is far ahead than any other country. So many psychoanalysts, so many schools of different psychoanalysis, psychiatry, psychology, psychosynthesis, analytical psychology, and many kinds of therapies are available to people. Millions of people are suffering from mental sickness. Millions of people are suffering from too much eating. Millions of people are suffering because they don't have any food, any clothes. This decadent America, this absolutely sick country, and Gorbachev wants to imitate America. He wants to become another President Ronald Reagan or George Bush, and he wants his beautiful Soviet land to be turned into a sick, decadent, rotten America. Yesterday I was telling you that Ronald Reagan is also nominated for a Peace Nobel Prize. I thought and thought what peace he has created in the world. Then I remembered that he has done something peaceful and he needs a Nobel Prize for it. Many of you must remember Rajneeshpuram, our commune in Oregon, America. It was a desert, 126 square miles, just pure desert. Has been for sale for 40 years and nobody purchases. What you will do with a desert? And we purchased it and we transform the desert into a beautiful oasis, and 5,000 sannyasins were living there, working there, dancing, singing, meditating. It was one of the joyous places in the whole world. So much dancing, so much joy, so much love, such friendliness, no family. The whole commune was one. So I remembered he has destroyed Rajneeshpuram violently and he has restored the peace of the desert. That seems to be the reason for his Peace Nobel Prize. Now again it is peaceful. No dance, no singing. The day I entered, there was only one house they have made for me. There was not a single bird. I was amazed to see, it looked like a nightmare. All around, just bare mountains with no trees, with no birds. In the morning you cannot hear a cuckoo, you cannot hear any TV, tut tut of all kinds of birds. Neither in the evening you can see thousands of birds coming back to their trees. It was a dead desert. We cultivated it, we made it green, we made artificial small rivers, we made a big dam. If even for 5 years there was no rain, we had enough water for 5,000 people. And at the time of festivals there were 20,000 people, and we had for 15,000 people beautiful tents, and we had created a new tent. And rather than giving us a reward for the new tent, we were punished. A court case was put against us that these people have created, without permission, a permanent structure. A tent is not a permanent structure. We had made a tent which can work all the year round, in rains, in summer when the snow is falling, in winter when it is too cold. It could be heated, it could be air conditioned. There was no question of any rains or any snow reaching in it. It was a totally new phenomenon. All those who saw it were immensely impressed that we have made something which can have a world market in Saudi Arabia or in deserts where people live in tents, but in the hot sun even the tent is just boiling. An air-conditioned tent you have never heard of. And in snow, in winter, the tent can be heated. It was absolutely safe all the year round. And a court case was against that we have made a permanent structure. I told to my attorneys, that just take a tent in a truck, take it inside the court, because it takes only 10 minutes to put it on and 10 minutes to take it off. A building that can be put in 10 minutes and can be taken off in 10 minutes cannot be called permanent. If the judge has any eyes to see, there is no need to any argument. It is not a question of law, it is a question whether the judge has eyes or blind. Can you put the White House in 10 minutes off and in within 10 minutes put it on? They called it permanent structure. Permanent structure needs license or permission from the government. And we never thought that a tent can be a permanent structure. With violence, with lawlessness against their own constitution, they destroyed the commune. That I remembered yesterday, that perhaps he has restored the peace of that dead desert. He deserves the Nobel Prize. I don't know any other peace that he has created. Gorbachev is trying to bring this decadent and mentally sick America into Soviet Union, where there is no psychoanalysis, no psychiatry. People are as mentally healthy as they have ever been anywhere, for the simple reason that their food is simple, nourishing, but not fattening. Their work is simple. Their life has no complications. The wife earns. There is no problem of continuous fighting that she wants a fur coat, she wants a new car, or she wants this and she wants that. And you cannot afford, you are going bankrupt. So rather than fulfilling her wishes, you jump from the 100-story building. The business is finished, the wife is torturing you, what else to do? So many people jump out of their windows. Do you think all these people are taking LSD? Because LSD is the only drug that gives the idea that you can fly. So LSD has to be taken only under guidance, and all doors and windows have to be closed. Because it creates the absolute certainty in the mind that you can fly. You just jump out of the window and open your wings. America has been discovered many times and always has been hushed back. Now that moment has come again. America has to be hushed back again and forgotten. Columbus has not done a great service to humanity. He is one of the enemies. Because 700 years before, America was known, but then hushed. 5,000 years before, America was known, but was hushed. Because whenever it seems the very land is poisonous, it drives people crazy. So it is not for the first time that we will have to huss it. It has been hussed many times, discovered again, hussed again. Now if you don't huss it again, it is going to destroy the whole world. And this poor fellow, Comrade Gorbachev, who is no more a comrade, wants Soviet Union to become America. He has forgotten, even if you become like America, you will be second rate. Soviet Union had a dignity of its own. Far more mentally healthy, far more physically healthy, it was Soviet Union who stopped the Second World War. If Adolf Hitler has not gone more insane because 5 years success, continuous success, and no Western power was able to prevent him. Great nations like France surrender in 24 hours. Naturally, he had a pact with Stalin before he started the war that we will remain friends. Neither you have to attack Germany nor we will attack you. Because he knew perfectly well in the First World War it was because of Russia's snows that Germany was defeated. Not by Russia's armies, just the snow is enough to destroy the enemy. When Russian snow starts falling, you cannot move an inch. All your tanks, all your trucks, all your food supply is blocked. And the snow is heavy and goes on falling for 6 months continuously. Your soldiers are covered, your tanks are covered, even helicopters cannot find where to drop the food. Everything has disappeared into a vast coverage of white snow. In the First World War, it was not the Tsar's soldiers, because they had returned home, but snow started falling. Germany got defeated. Hitler was aware of it. He made first a pact and treaty with Stalin that you will not attack us, and we will not attack you. And when Hitler went on winning for 5 years continuously all over Europe, and Japan was winning continuously for 5 years, even Calcutta was ordered to be vacated, because Japanese armies has reached Rangoon, and the second attack was Calcutta, and the third attack was Jabalpur, where I used to teach. Not at the time of Second World War, because Jabalpur was the very center of India, and because of its position, the British government has the biggest factory of armaments in Jabalpur. So after Calcutta, the second target was Jabalpur. Even Jabalpur was getting ready to be vacated. Once they attack Calcutta, Jabalpur has to be vacated. Such tremendous success got into the head of that madman Adolf Hitler, and he started attacking Soviet Union. He forgot the treaty, he forgot that Soviet Union has kept the world and has not interfered at all. And that was the point of his defeat. It was Stalin who is responsible for saving the world from Adolf Hitler and Hirohito and Benito Mussolini. Just not to give the whole glory to Soviet Union, America immediately rushed to help Europe. Up to now, America was keeping aloof. But when they saw that Soviet Union is going to have the whole glory of saving Europe and the whole world, they immediately rushed on both the fronts. MacArthur was sent with great armies to fight Japan, and Eisenhower was sent to Europe. Because if Adolf Hitler is going to be finished, the glory should be shared by Soviet Union and America both, not only Soviet Union. But it was in fact only Soviet Union who destroyed the Second World War and the desire of fascism to rule over the whole world. The fourth question, hearing you talk, I have the feeling that Christian fascism won't rest until it has destroyed every trace of communism. I feel Christians' vengeance against communism far powerfully challenging their word of God. That's true. The whole Christianity is against communism for the simple reason because they have thrown the Bible and thrown the God and thrown all Christian missionaries and Christian priests out of Soviet land. So the whole Christianity is sitting on a volcano, and America is basically a fundamentalist, fascist Christian country. It is so fascist in their ideologies that Charles Darwin's all the books Ronald Reagan ordered should be burned and his teaching should be prevented in every school, college, university, any research institute. All his books from all the libraries, all the colleges, schools, universities have been burned. Why? Because his idea of evolution goes against Christian idea of creation. This is real fascism. Certainly Christianity will take every chance to destroy communism, but it is not going to succeed. Seventy years has made Soviet Union strong enough. Gorbachev will be thrown out. Russia is not going on the way of capitalism and Christianity. The time has come when Soviet Union should say to Gorbachev, "Goodbye, comrade," and expel him from Soviet Union. He can have the Nobel Prize and he can go to America and become an Yankee. The Sutra. Our beloved master, when Ungan himself became a master, he once said when addressing an assembly of monks, here is a child from a respectable family. Whatever you ask, there is nothing he can't answer. You have to understand few symbols. Ungan himself became a master, he became an enlightened Buddha. Addressing an assembly of monks, he said, "Here is a child. Unless you become a child again, you cannot be a Buddha." That innocence is needed. And I am destroying all your conceptions in every possible way just to clean your mind and bring it closer to a child who knows nothing. Here is a child from a respectable family. He is not talking about ordinary families. In Zen, the family means the whole lineage of Zen masters. That is called the Dhamma family. From Buddha to Mahakashyapa to Bodhidharma to Rinzai, this is the family. He is not referring to his ordinary family. Whenever you come across the word family in a Zen anecdote, remember, they are referring to their masters who have given them their second birth. The first birth is physical, which parents give to you. The second birth is spiritual, which the only one who is enlightened can give you. It comes from master to disciple. This is the family. It goes back 25 centuries up to Gautam Buddha. So when Ungan said, "Here is a child from a respectable family," he is saying, "Here is another Buddha again from the lineage of thousands of Buddhas. That is my family. I am coming out of it. My master has given me a new birth. Whatever you ask, there is nothing he can't answer." This child, this innocent clarity can answer any question. Whatever you want to ask, you can ask and you will receive the answer. One of his disciples, Tozan, who finally became an enlightened master, stepped forward and asked, "How many books are there in his house?" You are talking about the child. He is asking how many books are in the house of the child. Because at that moment he was only a scholar. And he knew only, unless you have scriptures, you cannot answer all the questions. From where you will get the information? He has no idea that there is another source, transformation, from where answers simply arise, not out of information, but out of an inner revolution. At this moment he was only a scholar, so of course he asked, "How many books are in that child's house?" Ungan replied, "He does not have any books, not even a single letter." He is saying that a man who is awakened, there is not even a single letter, nothing to say about a thought, nothing to say about the scriptures. That child is absolutely innocent. There is no knowledge, no information. There is only a clarity. Out of that clarity, a response comes. That response is original and authentic to any question. Tozan then asks, how could he be so well informed? If the child you are talking about has no books, not even a letter, then how he can be so well informed that you are saying he can answer all your questions? This is the way of the scholar. He cannot go beyond the word. He cannot go beyond the scripture. He cannot go beyond information. Information comes from outside and transformation comes from inside. He is not aware that there is another way also. Not that the childlike consciousness, that purity, that innocence of a Buddha has all the answers in it. No, nothing. It has no answers. But as your question arises, that purity responds. It is a mirror, it shows your face. It reflects out of nothingness, out of silence, arises a right answer. Tozan asks, how could he be so well informed? Ungan's response is very important. He says, he seldom sleeps day or night. His awareness is so complete that there is no more any trace of sleep left in him. No more trace of any unconsciousness. No trace of any darkness. Everything has become so luminous and light. It is from this alertness, day and night, awareness, day and night, that his answers come from. Ananda comes to wake me up at 3:30 in the afternoon. It is a difficult task to wake somebody who is awake. So poor Ananda, as she opens the door, I say, hello Ananda. She has never had a chance to wake me up to now. Just hiding behind my blanket, I say, hello Ananda. Just the other day she was asking, it is strange, I opened the door so silently and you are hiding in your blanket and you immediately respond. Amrita knows that it is absolutely impossible for me to sleep. He tries every possible medicine and he brings all kinds of CD discs which create sleep. and the whole night I had to listen. But I'm not at all tired. In the morning when I wake up from my whole night of awakening, I have lost the very sense of time. That's why last night I went on. I would have gone on and on. Just I remembered Sardar Gurdayal Singh. Otherwise there was no question. Only in the car Ananda told, "Do you know it is 11:05? I said, "My God, that is a record." If I had not remembered Sardar Gurdayal Singh, last night was going to be a marathon discourse. Only early in the morning when sun would have been rising, I would have allowed you to go for breakfast. Someday it is going to happen. I want to ask something of the child, continued Tozan. Is it possible? He could answer, but he would not, replied Ungan. Now he is saying something very important. He could answer, but he would not. Because the answer will not be as authentic as his experience. The answer will be far below than the truth. So he can answer, he knows the truth, but he would not answer because he cannot betray the truth. So every Buddha is talking around and around, hoping that somehow you will look at the center, some point. But he goes on round and round, taking you in circles, pointing always to the center, but never saying a single word about your center. You have to experience it. You are the answer. So Ungan replied, he could answer because he knows it, but he would not because language does not allow it. The monk replied, on another occasion, Ungan asked a monk, "Where have you been?" The monk replied, "I have been talking about the Dharma to a rock." Ungan asked, "Did the rock nod?" Because in Zen, the rocks are as alive as you are. They grow. The trees are as sensitive as you are, perhaps more sensitive. You can talk. So Ungan does not question the fellow, "Are you mad talking to a rock?" On the contrary, he asks, did the rock nod? The question is not that you were talking. The question is whether the rock was listening. If it was listening, it would have nodded. The monk had no answer. And Ungan commented, "It nods before you talk." That's what makes Sardar Gulzar Singh special. He laughs before you tell the joke. Everybody laughs after the joke. That is very normal. But laughing before the joke shows immense trust. That something great is going to happen. Ungan said, "It nods before you talk." If you are really in tune with the rock, it nods before you start talking. And you have not even received the nod after you have stopped talking. Of course, the man was completely embarrassed, shocked. What this man is saying, that the rock nods before. It's really nods before. You have to be a master. Then everything is around you is always receptive, always ready to receive something from you. Even rocks are not rocks. They also have a heart, perhaps a different kind. The whole existence is alive. Nothing is without life. This is one of the fundamentals of Zen, that the whole existence is alive. That's why it can discard the concept of God. There is no need. The whole existence is alive, sensitive, intelligent, is capable of growing into a divine experience of being the awakened one. Basu wrote, "All the cuckoos dancing in the trees." The cuckoo is the sweetest musician. The cuckoo creates the sweetest song. Its body is ordinary. If you see the cuckoo, it looks just like a crow. Not much difference. But it has a tremendous spirit. When it sings, then there is no comparison to it. Basu must have opened his eyes sitting in a mango grove, because cuckoos are found more in a mango grove. They like the mangoes. The mango is thought, particularly in the East, as the king of all the fruits. It is. Its sweetness is such that wherever there are mango trees, you will find cuckoos waiting for the mangoes to become ripe. And when they become ripe, then they go really cuckoo, dancing, singing. The mangoes are ripe. They love the mangoes. The Baso must have been either by the side of a mango grove or inside. Buddha loved always his whole life to have his camps, because he was continuously moving, into mango groves. Perhaps India has more mango trees than any other country. And at Buddha's time, it has even more. Because it was thought one of the virtues to plant mango trees. All kings, all rich people tried to create as mango trees as possible. All roads were surrounded for hundreds of miles with mango trees, and every village, every town had its own mango grove outside the town, by the riverside or by the lake. Because the mango grove was the shelter of all the wandering mystics. The trees are very thick, shadowy trees, and when there are thousands of mango trees, they give a great cool breeze even in the hottest summer. And when the mangoes are ripe from all over, cuckoos come running to the mangoes, because the mango has a very special fragrance. That fragrance brings the cuckoos from far away. Until the mangoes last, they remain in the mango groves, singing and dancing. And their sound is certainly the sweetest sound in existence. So Baso must have come out of his meditation, and suddenly he saw all the cuckoos dancing in the trees. Just visualize these haikus always. See the mango trees, see the hundreds of cuckoos dancing, singing, and their sweet sound will fill your very heart. Manisha's question. Our beloved master, hearing you talk about communism being combined with Zen, Marx combined with Buddha, I had the flesh that Rosa Luxemburg would be delighted to hear you. I have the feeling that this is what she was looking for and could not find or express in her time. But she must have had the longing in her already. She wrote the following while she was in prison in Breslau, Germany, in 1917. Here I am lying alone, wrapped in these black folds of darkness, boredom, imprisonment, the winter, and at the same time my heart beats with an unbelievable, unknowable, unknown inner joy. In the darkness of life, I am smiling, as if I know some magic secret that gives the lie to all evil and sadness and changes it into bright light and happiness. I am looking for a reason for this happiness, and I don't find any. and I have to smile again, I think that the secret is nothing else than life in itself. Would you like to comment? Manisha, I have always loved the woman revolutionary Rosa Luxemburg. She is the topmost revolutionary as far as women are concerned. She had the same quality of revolution as Lenin. And she was a woman, so certainly she had a totally different approach to revolution. It has not to be just of the body, it has also to be of the soul. It has not to be just on the outside of man in the social structure, it has to be of man in his consciousness also. Certainly she was not aware of any meditative rebellion within. That's why she says, I am looking for the reason. And she thinks she has found the reason in life itself. But that is a very superficial reason. Without meditation, you don't know the secrets of life, you know only the surface of life. Even that much gives you enough joy. But you don't know the depth, the abysmal depth, and the infinite height, immeasurable both. Once you know this vertical dimension of height and depth, life becomes a pure joy, a laughter, a song, a dance, an ecstasy. Rosa Luxemburg was in a wrong place. She should have been in the East. Out of all the revolutionaries in the West, perhaps she was more sensitive and would have learned the Eastern way of getting deeper into life, not just the surface. On the surface, life becomes eat, drink, be merry. It is superficial. You get bored sooner or later. Unless you reach to the abysmal depth and the infinite height, simultaneously, you don't know what a miracle life is. What a mystery life is. But she was in search. She died before she could have found it. But death is not death. Rosa Luxemburg may be here. If not today, then tomorrow. All those who are seeking the depth of life and the secret, the ultimate secret of consciousness, are bound to move knowingly or unknowingly towards someone who has already reached the home. It is time for Sardar Gurdayal Singh again. Officer Pope Iski of the Warsaw Police Traffic Control Team is sitting in his car eating a potato sandwich. when he sees a bright red Ferrari speed past him at 180 miles per hour, Officer Dopeski nearly chokes on his sandwich in excitement as he slams his door, starts his car, flicks on his red flashing lights, flicks on his siren, fastens his seatbelt, checks his pistol, opens the glove box and looks for his ticket book, slams the gear shift into go and stomps on the gas pedal. 1 hour and 200 miles later, Officer Dopeski finally manages to stop the speeding Italian sports car. "Okay," says Dopeski, fumbling nervously with his ticket book. "Just tell me your name." The driver of the Ferrari looks up and says, "My name is Alfonso da Villa Martino Rivera Giovanni Tortoni Belloni." "Well," replies Officer Dopeski, perspiring, "don't do it again." Newton Houghton drops into the Lucky Luke saloon one evening and orders a triple martini. "What a coincidence," says Max, the bartender. "Just an hour ago, I was saying that nobody ever orders a triple martini anymore." As Max is mixing the drink, both he and Newton look up as Lucy Legs rushes in and asks for a triple martini. Newton and Max both look at each other in amazement. "Hey, lady," cries Max, "that is incredible. The gentleman here just ordered a triple martini, and we were just discussing how nobody ever orders that drink these days. This is really a coincidence." "Well," says Lucy, "I am celebrating a very special occasion. My husband and I have been married for 9 years, and we have always wanted a child. Just today, I have learned that I am pregnant." The two men congratulate Lucy, and then Newton says, "Well, that is a coincidence because I am also celebrating a very special occasion. I have been breeding exotic chickens for years, and I have been trying to produce a purple spotted hen, and just today I found out that I have been successful." "What a coincidence," says Lucy. "How did you manage it?" "Well," replies Newton, "I just changed cocks." "Wow," cries Lucy, "that really is a coincidence. Me too." Comrade Gorbachev has heard rumors that his policies are being discussed in Pune. In India. So he decides to go and check it out. When his plane arrives at Pune airport, the Indian army is there to welcome him. As Gorbachev steps off the plane, the military guard of honor fires off the traditional 21-gun salute. "What were those shots?" asks Swami Deva Coconut, standing in the crowd. "Gorbachev has arrived," says the man next to him. "Really?" replies Coconut. "You mean they could not get him with just one shot?" Nivedanam. Silent. Close your eyes and feel your body to be completely frozen. This is the right moment to turn in, gather your whole energy and rush towards your center of being with your total consciousness and with an urgency, as if this is going to be your last moment of life on the earth. This urgency is absolutely needed to reach to the center. Faster and faster, deeper and deeper. As you start coming closer to your center, a great silence descends over you, like soft rain. It is so tangible, you can feel it. As you come even more closer, a great peace arises from your very sources, surrounding you into great fragrance of the beyond. Just a little more, and you are on the center, facing your original face. Your original face is the face of the Buddha, the awakened one. At this moment you are the Buddha. I teach the Buddha, I don't teach Buddhism. The only quality Buddha has is witnessing. He is a pure witness. No judgment, no identification, just watching without having any opinion. Witness, you are not the body. Witness, you are not the mind. And witness, you are only the witness. And as you relax into witnessing, a great ecstasy, a great divine drunkenness overtakes you. you suddenly become aware of your immortality, of your eternal life. To make this witnessing deeper, Nivedano, relax, let go. But go on remembering you are a Buddha, a pure witness. And as your witnessing goes on becoming deeper and deeper and deeper and deeper, you start melting like ice in the ocean. I can see it. Gautam the Buddha auditorium is turning into an ocean of consciousness. 10,000 Buddhas have melted into one ocean. A pure ocean of consciousness without any ripples or waves. At this moment, you are the most blessed people on the earth. Just because you are centered at your very ultimate nature. The Buddha is your Dhamma. He is your very nature. The evening was beautiful on its own. But your totality, your intensity, your urgency, your honesty has made it a great splendor. The whole existence surrounding you is celebrating your great victory. There is no other victory greater than this. To become a Buddha is the most important, the most significant, the only meaningful act in your whole life. Gather as much experience and as many juices of life and the blossoms, and the flowers, and the fragrances, the peace, the silence, the serenity, the divine drunkenness, the ecstasy. Collect all of them. You have to bring them to your life. Your life has to become a life of songs, a life of dances, a life of eternal music, a life of divine ecstasy. This is the transformation which Zen fire and Zen wind brings to you. And never forget to persuade the Buddha to come along with you. He is coming every day closer and closer and closer. You will feel his presence just behind you, coming, following. Like a shadow. This is the first step of meditation. Buddha coming behind you as a shadow. But the shadow is very solid, very tangible. You can touch it, you can feel it. You can have a tremendous fragrance arising from it. The second step, you become the shadow and Buddha comes ahead of you, in front of you. The third step, your shadow disappears into the transparent awareness, awakening, enlightenment of the Buddha. You are no more. Only the Buddha is. You are no more. Only the existence is. This is the ultimate revolution, the ultimate evolution, the ultimate truth, beauty, godliness. Nivedana, come back, but come as Buddhas, with the same grace, the same beauty, the same joy, the same ecstasy. Sit down just for a few seconds to remember and to remind yourself where you have been, to what depth, to what height you have reached, to what opening of space you have experienced. And see that the fragrance of the innermost has come with you, surrounding your being. And watch, feel, the Buddha is standing behind you. He is your very nature. He is your blissfulness. He is your benediction. And the day is not far away when you will take the second step and become the shadow of the Buddha. And once you become the shadow of the Buddha, the third step becomes very easy. The shadow can disappear into the Buddha without any trouble. When only the Buddha is left alone, you have come home. This is the search of all human consciousness. This is the search of all living beings. This is the source from where we have come, and this is the goal to where we are going. Once the circle is complete, the source and goal meet together, you have come to a perfection of which you cannot even have a dream. You cannot even visualize what that perfection is. Even after reaching to it, you cannot manage to describe it, you cannot manage to explain it. You can simply dance. Your eyes will sign with it. Your silence will become a song about it. Your words may carry a little fragrance about it. Your very existence will radiate with the light that you have found in the completion of the circle, the source and the goal meeting, now once this happens to any consciousness, any human being, he is not to be born again into a prison of body, of bones and blood and flesh. Then he disappears into the cosmos and becomes one with the cosmos. Just a sincere passion to disappear into the cosmos is needed. It is not a long journey. It is just a quantum leap. And you are trying the best that you can do. I am absolutely happy about you. And the day when you all will start blossoming into Buddhas will not be only a day of happiness for you. It will be a day of great celebration for the whole existence. Okay, Manisha?
Yes, beloved.